what if is a much better mindset approach than that closed sort of like we've always done it this way. Because when you ask what if, like the whole world could open up. I know a lot of people look at us and they think we're like witchcraft practitioners, but I mean, I'm going to contend that the things that we do are we understand apraxia, right? That our students' minds and their bodies probably aren't connected well with each other, right? I hit the elevator button. I was like, I can't today. I cannot do this.
I feel right? like we've all been there.
Should not have done it. And
no.
Yet,
yeah,
we
exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
2 minutes later, I went stairs computer. And I was like, oh God, he is so smart, right? And I was like, oh, okay, all right. We got to learn to spell. We got to learn more than this.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to Think Inclusive, real conversations about building schools where every learner belongs. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today's episode is about opening up possibilities for communication for non-speaking students and what can happen when we truly presume competence. Our guest is Lisa Mahalik Quinn, founder of Reach Every Voice and co-founder of Adaptiverse, an AI-powered lesson adaptation platform. Lisa has spent her career building solutions that unlock grade-level access for non-speaking autistic learners and training educators to presume competence and embrace inclusion. We talk about why understanding apraxia and co-regulation is essential for supporting autistic learners, how presuming competence can transform lives, and what it takes to move beyond this is how we've always done it to what if we tried. Lisa shares her journey from public school teacher to innovator and tells the story of a breakthrough moment with a student whose world opened up once he had the right tools and expectations. Before we meet our guest, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by IXL. IXL is an all-in-one platform for K-12 that helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and tracks progress in one place. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs so that every learner gets just right support and challenge. And each student gets a personalized learning plan to close gaps. Check it out at IXL.com/inclusive. Again, that's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a quick break, it's time to think inclusive with Lisa Mahalik Quinn. Catch you on the other side. Lisa Mahalik Quinn, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast. I said that right, right?
You did. You did really well. Thanks for checking.
Sometimes you just never know. But Lisa and I have known each other for a while. And although you were on our panel, which was officially an episode, I have not interviewed you one-on-one. So this is a treat for me.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Lisa, Reach Every Voice. Let's talk about your journey.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Where do you want to start?
Dude, where do we start? You know, I tell everybody that I am a public educator by like, that's who I am. I was a teacher for a very long time in Maryland public schools, like almost 15 years. So we share that in common, right? We came from these classrooms that in places where we weren't always including kids. Mm. And even though I think I had a lot of luck in that I ended up in a classroom with or in a placement in a school system at the beginning where I was actually including people, right? That wasn't where I saw myself. That wasn't where I saw myself coming out of grad school. Like I really saw myself in a self-contained segregated setting, right? Because that's what I had seen modeled basically everywhere, right? That was the model that kind of sticks around here. But I did get really lucky in one internship and I saw what it looked like to see kids included. And, you know, when we were thinking about this interview, I was thinking back to like, how did I even get here? How did I get to be this teacher, right? My mom's a teacher. I feel like people who have teachers in their family, it kind of runs, right? My mom was like, don't do it. Don't do this.
I know. I know. I'm telling my kids that.
Right? Yeah, I will tell my kids that too. Don't do it. But I don't know, you know, just from a really young age, I can remember being in second grade. So in 1990, it was like the year of Desert Storm, right? I was in central Pennsylvania. And the things I remember from second grade are every morning being standing there and singing, I'm proud to be an American, while it played over the loudspeaker. And I remember that our school must have been part of some kind of pilot because there were students with really significant disabilities who showed up in our building, right? And nobody said anything about it. Wasn't like, oh, they're part of our community. It was those kids in that room over there, right? They were downstairs. They were off in a separate wing, but they'd be on the playground with us. And I was so intrigued. I was like, who are these people, right? Where did they come from? Why are they here? Like, hi, hello, right? And I can remember seeing the things that, like, as a teacher, we try and explain to our kids, right? These are kids who have different ways of communicating. They may not be able to say the same things that you want to say. And as a kid, I was so intrigued. Why is she pulling me off these monkey bars, right? Why is she doing that? And I just wanted to understand more. I wanted to understand better. And I was so, I don't know, just pulled in and probably came to this through the same lens that like a lot of people do, is this idea of like wanting to be a helper, wanting to like, right, be that person who's a helper. And I had a second grade teacher who one day, like during indoor recess, I went down to volunteer to help out, to be in that classroom. And I came back upstairs and she was like, where were you? Where were you during this time? And in front of the entire second grade lined up in the hallway, she said, were you down with those? And she dropped the R word. And like that to me, like makes me think about like how we need to be cautious about what we say to kids when they're so little, because they hold on to it. I'm here like decades later holding on to it, but it just sparked that like feeling of injustice, right? And so I think like I had other career paths. I went to GW for politics and English. I started an English PhD program. I worked at the Pentagon and like none of it stuck. Like that wasn't it for me. So when I started teaching, I knew that was it. And I feel like when I got into the school system, a lot of it was so awesome and so amazing, being able to connect with my kids, being able to support them. I was in an assistive technology program, supporting students with AAC devices in inclusive settings. And, you know, they closed it. I was there for 6 years and then they closed my part of the program. And so when that happened, it's like a lot of things went up in the air and I moved to different schools, which I'm very grateful for. I'm grateful for the experience of seeing different things and different buildings, because a lot of teachers, I think, get stuck in one place, one experience. And that's how we develop the mindset of like, this is the way we do things. We only do things this way. This is the way it works, right? We've always done it this way. So traveling to different schools gave me a lot of different experiences, introduced me to a lot of different teachers, a lot of different students. And as I did that, I took a role supporting a pilot program for kids who were using letterboards, keyboards, spelling, typing to communicate. And I learned so much. And what I learned was that my autistic students that I had over the years, we knew really nothing about them, right? I had everything I learned in grad school basically was wrong. Instantly regretted all the ABA I'd ever done. I did a lot of learning on the job. And we were given some training as we went into it, but it was a lot of hands-on learning. And so as I was there, as I was working with these students, you know, one of the things that happened was they were so smart. They were communicating. They were taking grade level classes, fully immersed in their middle school classes. But they were told, essentially, you don't qualify for ESY because you're on grade level. We know that's not true. That's not how it works, right? There's a whole process you go through to determine how you qualify for ESY. And if you have communication deficits, like critical life skill communication, you're going to qualify. But nobody wanted to fight our district on communication. They were all like, that's cool. Here's what we really want. We want a program. We want a program that like lets us practice our communication skills. Let's us learn about the things we want to learn about. Let's us play games that aren't like chutes and ladders and Candyland with our friends, and let's us build these friendships. And I was like, cool, I can do that. I can make that happen. And that's how Reach Every Voice started. That was a long way to get here. But we started as a 6-week summer program. That was 10 years ago. And like we just keep changing. People ask us what we do, and it's hard to describe like in a single sentence or in an elevator pitch, because we're always evolving in response to the needs of our community. Like we started as these enrichment programs, summer, weekend. And then what we found was like some of our students, our core group of students, their needs were at that time being met in their school system, but there were so many others whose needs weren't being met. So we started branching out and saying, okay, cool, we can support you outside of school. We can support you in individual sessions. We can support you in the community. And we've grown and evolved. And now, you know, we're supporting probably 50 some ish per people in person, individual group sessions. And we have a whole bunch of online services that we offer.
And when did it start? When was that you started the enrichment or the program?
So the lead up to it was like 2016 was our first summer.
Oh, wow. So you're coming up on 10 years.
Yeah. This is our 10th summer. Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty incredible. I know. I mean, you started out by making me feel old. This makes me feel older. We're doing good, Tim.
Yeah. I expect this to continue, so just buckle up.
I'm on for the ride. It's all good.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that it's important to hear people's stories and how we got to the place where we are now. And your experience working in schools and. I guess appreciating all the different like ways learners are supported and you being able to see that. I think that was for me as well. Like I was in three classroom settings over the course of my career. And then the last 3 years I did I was a program specialist. So I was at different schools, so I could see lots of different ways learners are being supported, some inclusive, some very not much so. But I think that really gave me a lot of perspective. So it sounded like that gave you a lot of perspective as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that's holding people back from like being able to include students well is the idea of like, it must be done a certain way, right? Like, this is how we do things. This is how it's always been done. When you don't have the flexibility and the creativity to think outside the box, nothing's going to change, right? We're going to keep doing things the way we've been doing things. And we know that it doesn't work for a lot of our students with more complex needs. But when you find the people who do have that creativity and that willingness to take a risk or take a chance and say, well, what if we try this? What if we try that? Like, that's when I think that's when the magic happens.
And you took a risk with creating like Reach Every Voice.
That was so scary. Like, there's so much stability in a school system job, right? Like,
yeah,
it's safe. It feels really safe. And like knowing you have a pension, knowing you have all those things in place, like, it's hard to leave. I understand why people stay, even if they are burned out or even if they are struggling and don't agree with the system. I get it. I completely understand it. But it is super terrifying to own a business and be out here every day. Like, especially, you know, things change. Things change in our climate and our world around us. It's terrifying. And yeah. I'm so glad I did it. Like, I'm so glad. I wish I could put myself out of business and like or maybe have an entirely different model, right? I wish I didn't have to be providing these level of individualized supports of teaching people like how to communicate, how to like get like be providing the literacy instruction I provide to kids, because they should be getting that in school. I wish we could be doing the work of supporting schools to be doing this in public school settings, right? No parent should have to be paying me to do that. They should be able to get this in their schools. So like that would be a dream. And then I wouldn't have to, you know, take on all the terror of owning businesses, but
yeah, that's a, that is, so let's unpack that for a little bit, because what I'm hearing you say is that learners who, you know, type, spell, however, to communicate, they are not being educated in their school the way that they can be, and they are being educated at Reach Every Voice. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, for the large part, that's true. Yeah.
Right, right. So then who is paying, like the parents and families are paying out of pocket to basically have their students learn, right? Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, you can call us tutors, I guess, right? Mm. Like you can compare it to a tutoring model. Whenever you don't have kids getting what they're needing in school, you're paying a tutor. We're all certified teachers. That's one way to look at it. But
yeah.
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 What, so what do you think is the big difference? So if a student is not getting something at their school, yet you are able to provide it, what is the biggest difference? I guess we can start there.
Tell me what you mean by that.
So why can you do it and the other in the school can't?
Oh, I don't know if it's a matter of can't. I think it's a matter of won't or don't believe in it, perhaps. Don't believe in the possibility, the potential. A lot of the students who come to us, like, you know, going back to what I said about, you know, I had to unlearn everything I learned about autism. And a lot of the schools that we see around us are really steeped in this understanding of autism as a intellectual and behavioral disorder. So they're looking at their students through this lens of this child is severely intellectually disabled, and this child is, this child has behaviors that need to be modified, that need to be changed, right? So a lot of our classrooms have self-contained segregated autism programs where students are doing some version of ABA all day long, right? And our kids are participating in discrete trial things all day long. And what exposure they're getting to grade level curriculum is minimal. The things that they're being asked to do is being held up until they can prove understanding. They can prove that they can do a certain thing before they're allowed access to something else, right? So we don't do that. We're not going to make you prove to us that you can read or sit still before we're going to read to you at a grade level, before we're going to talk to you as if you are the age that you are, right? From the second you walk in through our door, if you're 15, we're talking to you like you're a 15-year-old. If you're 4, we're going to talk to you like you're 4. If you're 64, our oldest clients are in their 60s, we're going to talk to you like you're, that's the age that you are, right? We're going to treat you with that level of respect, and we're going to presume that you're competent and capable of learning. We're also going to understand that you probably have some big gaps in your knowledge because you haven't been given access to information for a long time. So I know a lot of people look at us and they think we're like witchcraft practitioners, but I mean, I'm going to contend that the things that we do are we understand apraxia, right? That our students' minds and their bodies probably aren't connected well with each other, right? That they... a lot of their movements that they're making are impulsive and not within their control. So if I ask a student to go pick up the keys off my desk and they come back with the crayons that are next to them, I'm not going to assume that they don't know what keys are or crayons are. I'm going to assume that they knew what the desk was. There was some problem of execution in that action, right? It's not a problem of cognition. It's a problem of that execution right in the moment. And then we're going to work on coaching their bodies. We're going to work on coaching their motor systems to be able to do the things that they need to do. Most specifically, in regards to literacy, which a lot of our students aren't taught, right? Because they're presumed that you could never handle this. We'll give you some symbols. We'll give you some pecs, maybe. We'll give you a Big Mac to hit. But it's only programmed with that one phrase that we put on there
Big
for
Mac.
You.
Oh, Big yes.
Mac, right?
Yes.
I mean, step
communicator.
Step by step, if you're lucky, you get a couple things you can cycle through. But it's only what I put on there for you. And like, listen, I did that. Like, I taught 10 apples up on top with like counting on a step by step. 100% have done that. Yep. And I just like, I feel like when you know better, you have to do better. So, right? Like, we're teaching our kids the literacy skills. We're taking into account the knowledge of apraxia, the knowledge of literacy skills, plus like this idea that with behavior, our kids aren't doing this stuff on purpose. They're not coming in here trying to be bad. They're not coming in here trying to. The other day I was sitting in a room with one of my older students and a little five-year-old went like through the room. The room has two doors and he came in and did a couple laps. Nobody was fazed. Nobody's yelling. We're just like, hey, how's it going? Like the only comment is, oh my gosh, how amazing to have access to these things as a five-year-old, right? That was the comment from my older learner. He's like, I wish when I had been that young, like someone had brought me and like known that I could do this.
Oh, man.
So we're understanding like this idea of co-regulation. We put it all together and we're teaching literacy skills and movement.
I think apraxia and co-regulation are two things that are like the knowledge gap in special education teachers, like right now, the it's like chasm. Like I think that those two things, if we spent as much time as we do about, you know, autism characteristics and, you know, behaviorist principles and, all that stuff. If we kind of like, even if we just balanced it out a little bit more, I think it would be totally a game changer for special educators. Because those are the things that I learned later in my career, that were so helpful. And, I want, if for anyone who's listening, Lisa and I were both teachers in quote unquote, we taught autistic learners specifically. And I remember, and tell me if you remember this too, like early on, just giving any sort of like verbal, what's it called? Manned? Was it a manned, mm-hmm. right? Kind of like a verbal instruction, right? Mm-hmm. And you could see the learner like they wanted to do it. Like you could see it and I saw it, but like they couldn't. Or like it's like I knew that they knew the right answer, but they could not tell me the right answer. But I knew they knew the right answer. And sometimes they would point or touch the wrong answer. And I'm like, I know you know this.
Yeah. That's so frustrating.
Right?
But it's like
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because what you see is like so convincing, but you know, it's like this weird cognitive dissonance, right? Like, you know, your kids are so smart. You know it, but like they're doing the things that you're like, ah, what's happening here?
Right.
And it's even worse when they have a little bit of language. Right. Or when they have speech, when they have a little bit of speech,
yes,
right.
Okay. Yeah,
it makes it almost worse. Like,
yeah,
you know, because their speech can be so convincing. And like, we have some people here who speak and that speech, like, you know, I had somebody two months ago, maybe in a session with me, just stuck, just saying like Panera Bread, Panera Bread, Panera Bread, Panera Bread. One would think, where does he want to go? Panera Bread. He is spelling out, I cannot go to Panera Bread today. Please take me somewhere with greasy food. And like, his, you know, his support person's like, all right, man, where do you want to go today? And he was like, I don't know, can we go to Five Guys? And she's like, yeah, totally, no problem. Meanwhile, his whole body is getting red and he's just going, Panera Bread, Panera Bread. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what is going to happen? They're going to walk into Panera Bread, or they're going to walk into Five Guys, and everyone in the world is going to look at this like person screaming Panera Bread and think, why won't they just take them to Panera Bread?
Just take them to Panera Bread. Yeah. Yeah.
I look at them later. I was like, guys, how did it go? I've been so worried. What happened? Like, just like, oh, it's fine. No problem. We went to, there was like 2 seconds of like dysregulation at the door, and then they got the things that they actually wanted.
Right.
It was what they really wanted, and they were able to tell us that. Meanwhile, we would just be thinking like, it's so tricky.
It's so tricky.
Like, that's what the whole world relies on, is listening to a speech, right? We're sitting here talking to each other.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Which is why what you are doing and other, you know, other people, other organizations, companies are giving access to just communication for non-speakers, I think is just, and like unreliable speakers too, like what you were just talking about, how someone is saying something, but it and you are maybe interpreting it as they wanted to go to Panera Bread, but they definitely did not want to go to Panera Bread. They wanted to do something else, but they weren't able to access that communication. So, and I don't know. I think that that's so powerful. I hope that people listen and are like, tell me more about this. Tell me, you know, I want to know how do we give access? After the break, Lisa shares how her team is training educators and families across the country. And we dive into the real-world impact of giving non-speaking students access to robust communication tools. Plus, you'll hear a powerful story about a breakthrough moment that changed everything for one learner. This show is produced by the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, MCIE. MCIE partners with educators and school systems to promote authentic inclusion, foster change, and support the implementation of inclusive practices, whether it's district-wide transformation, customized learner planning, or professional learning and coaching. MCIE walks alongside educators every step of the way. And here's the best part. Our work begins with a conversation. So if you're ready to create schools where every learner belongs, visit mcie.org to get in touch and start that conversation today. So maybe we should go to and start talking about the services that you provide, because you have learners come to you, but you also train educators. So
yeah,
tell us more about that.
Yeah. One of the first things I did in terms of training was during the pandemic, when like every parent had to become the default educator, right? Parents were like, oh God, our kids are home. What do we do now? So I created a course called Accessible Academics. It is very low production value, but I think arguably very high, like, content value. It's me with a document camera modeling how I make grade level content accessible to somebody who can maybe just make choices, right? And that has been taken by over 300 parents and educators. It's a self-paced course. It was live originally because we were all home during the pandemic. We had nothing better to do. But now it's all self-paced. And that's something, you know, that I think is like so like simple and fundamental, like just little things where you're like, oh, now I've seen it. I could do this. I can do this, right? I can go and do this little thing in my classroom, or I can do this little thing with my kid at home now. So that's one thing we do. We also, you know, we work as some of our local families or families further away, they have us consult on IEPs or like work with their teams, but it's a much bigger thing, right? That's not sustainable to work one-on-one with every team in the nation who might have this problem. And like, so one of my big dreams was to develop like a training program that could really support this. And I have two really good friends, one who is a researcher at Cal Lutheran University, and she's the co-founder of the Autism and Communication Center and the mom of a non-speaker. This is Edlyn Pena, and my friend Julie Sando, who's the director at Autistically Inclined. And so we got together and we all had the same goal, right? We wanted to create a training program that primarily focuses on how to support educators or people, and we know we have a lot of homeschool educators in this population, unfortunately, but so all sorts of educators, right? And how do I support these learners in a school setting, right? What are all the things that go into it? Because you were saying too, like this apraxia and co-regulation, like, man, these are the two huge things creating this chasm of understanding. Like, how do we bridge that? A lot of times when we see folks training people with communication tools, they're training just on the tool. They're training on the platform. They're training on whatever device it is. But they're not taking into account all the other support needs, right? All the things that go into regulating someone who needs to use the device, regulating somebody, or like adapting the content that needs to go along with it. So we created a course called Communication for Education that does all of that, right? It's the foundational groundwork to become a communication support partner in a school. And excuse me, we rolled it out in 2022, I think, with a pilot group. We got some grant funding from Ability Central in California and the Autism Communication Center. We rolled it out with a pilot group. We collected data from our participants in the early year just to like see their growth. And we had like statistically significant growth among our participants and their knowledge areas and their practice areas. And like what the coolest thing for me was we got a couple of grants to run it in schools. So we ran it in a preschool in Massachusetts. We ran it in a low-income school, elementary school in Colorado, and a transition center in Brooklyn. So three totally different schools. We had cohorts in each of them. And it was just incredible to watch these like multidisciplinary teams over the span of the program go from like people on the teams doubting, not thinking like their kids were capable of it, being like, we teach emotions. It's so important to come in every day and tell us whether you're feeling happy or sad, to at the end saying, hey, we taught Shakespeare this week and it was amazing, right? They came in saying like, we did Hamlet with our kids and we were talking about it. I was like, that's incredible. And they had found ways to make them, you know, to incorporate choice, to incorporate like pointing to answers and having like literacy skills included in what they were doing. Like, that's an incredible transformation, right? Like, that's what we want to see. And so even though some of those, like some of those were inclusive settings, some of them very much weren't. But the change in the attitudes of our participants, right? From like a school psychologist who was like, I didn't even know how I was going to use this course, to saying, oh, I'm pulling kids in and they're using their talkers with me. I understand how to scaffold communication now so that I can better have conversations. Like, that's the kind of response we want to see. So that's really like, so that's our, that's my excitement, right? And how we can get teacher educators and like future teacher educators, current educators, to change their mindset about it is possible, right? This isn't anything like shocking or outside of the ordinary. It's putting best practices for teaching and applying them to people who might not be speaking.
Right. And if you go on Amazon or other, I guess, booksellers, you can get the Breaking Barriers for Non-Speaking Autistic Students, a toolkit to enhance communication and learning environments, which came out this year. So I did preview this, and so people can use the book or the toolkit on its own, but you do have a course that can that runs like concurrently with it. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So these are like, there's probably, I guess, it's 100 and some page book, like front and back. And it's all the handouts that go along with the course, right? We designed it to be all of the There's a lot of takeaway. One of the most impactful things, I think, from the course is hearing from non-speaking autistic people who get to tell us about their experiences, right? So we've captured a lot of that in the book. We have some really key takeaways about concepts, like we were talking about earlier, about apraxia, about adapting academics, about regulation, dysregulation, some strategies for those things. So it's stuff that, you know, you could hand off to a teacher or a team and say, this is a great place to start. And then it connects with our course, right? It goes alongside the course that we teach.
Awesome. And we will put all of that in the show notes as well as your website. I'm wondering if we could go tell another story, if you have one, about maybe a moment where you witnessed a breakthrough in communication. I think people would love to hear your perspective on a learner who, you know, kind of made that jump from not being able to communicate to being able to communicate.
Yeah, maybe I'll tell you two, because one's super short.
Sure.
So one of them was one of my fourth graders when I was still teaching in public schools. And he had I don't know if it was a Dynavox or a Springboard. He had some device, right, that he was using. And he loved the elevator. This was his special interest. It was his obsession, right? It was a little dangerous at times. But when he got to his device every day, he would just tell me every day, I want the elevator. I want the elevator. I was Miss Mihalik then. Miss Mihalik, I want the elevator. I want the elevator. I want the elevator. And in one of my not best moments, I hit the elevator button. I was like, I can't today. I cannot do this.
I feel right? like we've all been there.
I should not have done it. And
no.
Yet, there
yes,
we were.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
2 minutes later, I went stairs computer. I went stairs computer. I went stairs computer. I went stairs computer. And I was like, oh God, he is so smart, right? And I was like, oh, okay, all right. We got to learn to spell. We got to learn more than this. Like, this device is not, like, we can do more. And within, like, I don't know if it was like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, this kid was poking through stencils. He switched to a Bluetooth keyboard. It wasn't just me. Like, that's one of the big hangups that people have when they see kids spelling or typing on letterboards, on keyboards. They're like, well, they can only do it with her. It's not real.
Right. Yeah.
That's a thing. Like, we don't do that here. You're going to learn with your parents. You're going to learn with multiple people. This kid was doing it with his aides, with his speech pathologist. And we had a meeting. This kid was on an alternate curriculum track. We had an IEP meeting where we moved him from a non-diploma bound track back to diploma bound. I've never done that in my entire life. Like, never have I ever. It was always the other direction, and it made me so sad, right? But I was just like, this is incredible, right? He has gotten this ability to communicate. And of course, there's people walking around thinking, oh, is it really him? Is it really him? So this child spoke Korean at home, and he's with me, standing with me. And I had an intern at the time who spoke Korean. And he's standing next to him, and he says something to him in Korean. Now, I'm holding his board as he responds, and he spells out the word always. I said, hey, what did you say to him? He said, oh, I said, oh, do you understand me when I talk to you? He spelled out always. So unless I also have subconsciously learned Korean, this is this child, like, genuinely answering, right? Like, that's the magic that, like, we're looking for, right? This kid is so smart, and he didn't have a way to tell us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was my short story. That was your short story?
That
I
was
like,
short story.
Okay, now tell a long story.
That's a long story. Never mind. I'm all good.
No, we have time. This is it's a podcast. You can tell. Podcasts are for stories.
I don't know. The other story I was going to tell you, I guess a lot of people who follow us on social media are familiar with Nick. Nick is like one of our young adults, and he does a lot of our social media. He presented at the TASH conference last year. And last year, someone asked him to reflect on his journey, just learning to communicate, right? So I was going to talk about Nick too, because Nick is somebody who scripts a lot. He talks about his scripts in some of his posts. And so Nick just reflected on his journey. And like, I was the one who taught Nick with the letter board. And he wrote about like this person, this lady chasing him around his living room with a board, and like how he was sort of confused at first. And like, he's like, she was nice. And she was just like, you know, she was taught, I was intrigued by what she was doing, but I couldn't get my body to do what I wanted to do. Right. And he wasn't interested in anything I was bringing up, but he had no way to tell me. Right. I would ask him, I'd say, hey, do you want to do something else? And he talks about like how his body would stupidly point to the last thing that I said. Right. And so consequently, I'm teaching him things he has no interest in because it's what his body just pointed to automatically. And then one day it just clicked. We were talking about Schoolhouse Rock because I knew it was one of the shows that he like watched on his loops. And I was like, let's just learn about the history of it. Right. I don't want to talk about like sing the songs with you, but let's learn about the history. Why did it come about? Who were the people involved? And like, that's the day we kind of had this breakthrough where he started spelling all these other things. And so I think like Nick is just such a really cool like example of what communication has done for his life, because he's been able to just direct like what his days look like, what his, you know, he's got an internship, what his life look. He comes here for a co-op. He's decided this year, like last year, his big thing he wanted to do was to go to a conference and present. And he did. Like, he co-wrote our conference presentation with me. If you put it all together, he went, he presented. This year, he decided he wants to organize, like from the ground up, like a local, like a table at an event. Great. Like, that is like, he's taking control of his life and getting to determine everything about his day-to-day life.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's great. Thank you for sharing that. I think people who listen, who are not familiar with spelling, I'm going to ask a question for them because I think that I think it's a good question. So learners who spell, how do they know how to spell? Like,
well,
you know what I mean? Like, because is so many times a learner will be in a segregated classroom where they are not taught literacy. They are not taught to learn how to read. They are not explicitly taught these things. But when they're given access to spelling or typing, it seems like the rate of learning is like exponential. So help us understand, or maybe they already know how to spell some words. So like, help us understand that, how that happens.
Well, one thing I know is that my learners, my students they don't read the way that I read. Their brains don't work the same way. So okay. I'm making an assumption that they haven't acquired that knowledge in the traditional way that I have acquired my learning of how to read. I didn't know that until I took, are you familiar with like the MAP assessments, like MAP Growth, MAP R, MAP M? It's like a reading test, right? So okay. It's on the computer. I wasn't allowed to read it to my students. Basically, there's a chunk of text on screen. They answer multiple choice. So I took it with one of my students who uses a letter board, and the text would come up on the screen. They would tell me their letter. I would enter it. We'd go to the next question, right? So I was taking it with one student in particular, and he's somebody who just like typically had no interest in like tests and scores, right? They don't mean anything to me. They don't show you anything about me. So he flew through this test. Like, I couldn't have followed along. I couldn't have read what was on the screen because he was just giving me an answer so fast. And I was like, all right, dude, this is your test. We get to the end and his score was like above grade level. Mm-hmm. And that, could it be luck? Sure, maybe, right? But I doubt it, right? And I said, explain to me what just happened, because my brain doesn't work like that. I could not have read everything that was on that screen, everything that you just read. And he told me that his brain takes a picture of the information and then it floats into his head like a file folder, or like floating into a file folder. I was like, awesome, my brain doesn't do that. That's not how it works for me. Mm-hmm. Like, cool, but thank you for sharing. And so to me, that was just like, it was eye-opening that I don't, there's a lot of stuff I don't understand, right? So sure. When I get people who come to me, my guess is that they have probably been absorbing environmental print and making sense of it for a lot of their lives. I do notice that a lot of my kids who watch YouTube videos turn the captions on. I don't know if that's so they can read along with it. I don't, you know, I'm not sure why they do that. I do also assume that I might need to teach them things, right? My little, mm-hmm. my guys who come to me, they're very little. We teach them phonetics. We teach phonetically as well as we're teaching the motor, so that we are giving them that knowledge, even if they don't need it, right? Even if they might not need it. I think it's helpful to understand the sounds that letters make, so that if you don't know how to spell a word, you have a repair strategy, right? You could spell something out. So the only thing I can say, right, because I don't have the answer, sure. is that they're absorbing information everywhere around them. Like my students have told me, when you can't speak, you have a lot of time to listen, to look, to observe, to put things in, like to put things into place around you. And I mean, just sitting here, like there's so much print behind, you can't see me if you're listening. There's so much print behind me on all the books behind me, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that that's a really good point. And if people aren't talking to you or providing you with, you know, print resources or anything like that, I guess they have this opportunity to, it's like self-direction. Like they can go and learn whatever they want to learn. Like maybe it is on mm-hmm. YouTube, or maybe it is, you know, being exposed to, you know, other sort of print that we don't know about. I just know that it feels like autistic learners definitely learn differently, right? Than if you're not. So the typical ways of like gaining knowledge, especially in print and literacy, won't necessarily be the same. But what you said about teaching reading and like kind of the quote unquote science of reading, right? I think it's still really important. So mm-hmm. I don't know. I could hear that question rolling around in people's heads. What were we going to say?
Did you see there is an article that came out this week, and I haven't read the whole thing yet. I just read the abstract, but it was some researchers in Canada who had studied young autistic learners and how they interacted with letters versus neurotypical learners and how they interacted with letters. And like, it was just that it was like focused on certain behaviors, like things that autistic learners did, like when they were young, like preschoolers, right? They tended to like have a favorite letter, to be like more focused on letters, to line them up, to like make patterns with them, to like form them into like even like word chunks, right? And this was like very not similar, right? It was very different from how typical brains interacted with letters at the same age, right? So they were doing all these things. They might do it on screens. They might do it with blocks. They might do it with magnets. But it was a study that showed like these learners had a really strong love of letters and numbers at a very young age. So it had some sort of meaning, some sort of connection with them from a really small age, when even like our more neurotypical students weren't connecting with them or weren't showing that connection.
Yeah. Yeah. And as so as you were saying that, I'm reminded of a student I had. This was my early career. And his decoding skills were phenomenal. Like he could read a passage on grade level, no problem. But it was the reading comprehension, or what I had assumed was reading comprehension, as the deficit. But I'm rethinking this whole thing, because what if he understood perfectly and it was the apraxia that was in the barrier, the apraxia and the co-regulation that were the barrier to him letting us know what he actually knew. So, wow. Just wow. All right.
I know, right? All the kids pop up in your mind and you're like,
Oh my gosh.
What if I had known? I know.
Yeah. Okay, let me look. I've been way off on the questions now. Like, we just kind of,
it's all good.
You know, went on a wild ride. So I'll ask one more question and then we'll wrap up. I think I'd like to know maybe your vision, or kind of what you hope will happen. Let's think about like the next 5 to 10 years in public schools.
Oh,
and we're going to be positive. We're going to be positive and hopeful.
Okay.
So we are going to speak this into existence.
Let's do it.
Of how people, you know, like your organization and others who want to give this access to students, how can there be a collaboration between what you're doing and what public school is doing, or I guess any school, but you know, how do you see that working in a positive and hopeful way?
Yeah. So let's speak it into existence here. I think it's going to be a couple things. I think we're going to see some of the people who do believe in inclusion getting into more senior leadership roles. And that's where we're going to see the change happen. The people with the mindset of possibility, right? What if we try? And once they're in those places, that's going to be key to us getting students access to their preferred communication, which is actually protected by the ADA, although many schools are trying to fight that. And I think that getting this knowledge about apraxia and regulation to be more mainstream, right, to be changing more minds, is going to be crucial. So there are a lot of people doing that work. I tend to get into a little bubble on social media of like following people who have the same kind of, the people who are already in the know, mm-hmm. right? So I think that, like, I don't know, the work you're doing with the podcast, the work that like other people out there are trying to do to make this a more knowledge, and not necessarily the people in the school systems, but they're impacting the people who will enter the school systems. They're impacting those folks who are going to be working there or who already are working there. I would love to see, you know, I would love to see people in teacher training programs have this knowledge before they leave.
We are going to be hopeful that continues to happen, and educators will gain this knowledge, and it will be part of their you know, teacher education, so they come in, you know, and maybe they're even working already, but like with like presuming competence and seeing that this is an option to explore.
Yeah. So. And I mean, like, just thinking about like how far, like not even just specific to kids using letterboards, right? Like the democratization of AAC should be huge for so many kids. It should be, and yet it's not yet, right? I still see a lot of schools saying, well, we can't do that. They don't need it. But when I started teaching, I had a kid who I thought needed a touchscreen. And let me tell you that it took a very long time and like a whole team to come out to literally hang a touchscreen on one monitor for me. It was like a separate thing you put on top. It was like 15 pounds. Mm-hmm. And we don't need that anymore, right? There's all these things that are embedded into our technology that are so supportive of needs. And that's what we have to really sort of do. You know, it needs to be that understanding of UDL and like how are we making all learners, right? UDL principles like make sense for everybody from a young age. And that includes maybe in preschool, we give every kid a letter board. Every kid is learning letters and letter recognition. Like, let's not single out the ones who can't speak. Let's hand every kid a laminated piece of paper with the alphabet on it. And everybody can point to a letter.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. Yeah. I like it. Anything you want to leave educators with?
Yeah. Instead of saying, this is how we do things, switch it over to what if we tried? What if? Like, what if is a much better mindset approach than... Mm. That closed sort of like we've always done it this way. Because when you ask what if, like the whole world could open up.
We've talked about how presuming competence and understanding apraxia can open up new possibilities for non-speaking students, and heard Lisa's insights on transforming both classroom practice and educator mindsets. But before we wrap up, it's time for one of our favorite traditions. The mystery question. Awesome. Are you ready for a mystery question?
I am never ready for a mystery question. So go ahead and we'll see what
okay.
happens.
So these are written by my 12-year-old.
Oh boy.
And there's that she needs to write more because I've only got two left. So okay. We're just going to. Actually, I'm going to make you pick. So it's yellow or blue. And I know that's not technically blue. It's probably another kind of blue, but I'm not good at colors. So
I'm going to go with the yellow one then.
Yellow. Okay, here we go.
Yellow.
Here we go. If you got a tattoo. I mean, you may already have one. So.
I don't. So.
Okay. Boy. I also do not. So if you got a tattoo, what would it be?
What would it be?
There you go. That's my daughter's.
Oh, Lord.
Yes.
If I got a tattoo, what would it be?
While you're thinking, I do have, I'm going to grab something. Hold on a second.
I'm kind of a chicken, Tim. I don't know that I would want that pain. Like, if I got a tattoo.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to show you a drawing.
Okay.
I'm going to show you drawing. So.
Okay. Is this your tattoo?
Well, there's a story. There's a story. I've never said this publicly. So this is a drawing by Mark. Let's just call him Mark because I don't remember his last name. Like, I can't say it. But a long time ago, I commissioned this to be a tattoo. For myself. And what it is, it's a cartoon skull. I'm not good at describing things, but it's basically got four marigolds around the skull. And it's like a cartoonish kind of Day of the Dead type of skull. And for reasons that I'm still not going to say publicly. I decided not to get the tattoo, and probably will never get one, but If I were to get one, that would probably be the one.
That's fair.
But I don't think it's going to happen. But that is a thing that happened. So
that's fair. You know, and I've never thought about getting a tattoo. It's never been a thing that's like sparked something for me. I know so many people who have because it's meant something to them. I don't even know what I would do. It might be something that would like mean something to me for my kids, my family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Man.
My wife has tattoos. My oldest daughter just got her second tattoo and she's still 18. So we are definitely not against tattoos or anything like that. I'm probably in a different place than I am when I, you know, made that. But I don't think that there is something that I'd want tattooed on my body at this point.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The other day we were standing at a daycare picnic and my son, like I was never allowed to even get temporary tattoos when I was a kid.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. I think they're fun, right? But like, absolutely. I don't care. My son said, "Can I go get a tattoo, mommy, at this picnic?" I was like, "Yeah, go ahead." And he came back with like a giant dragon across his forehead and something else on his cheek. And I was like, "Oh, I'm taking Post Malone to Disney tomorrow." Like we went on our Disney World trip with these like huge tattoos on his face. Oh, so I'll let him get my tattoo for me.
There you go.
He's going to take care
of it.
There you
go. There you go. There you go. All right. Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate, you playing along with the mystery question.
All right.
Lisa Mihalik-Quinn, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Lisa Mihalik-Quinn. You know, I keep thinking about the students I taught, the ones who I knew had the answers, but just couldn't show me in the way that they were expected to. And honestly, I keep wondering, what if I knew then what I know now? I find myself really in line with Lisa's thinking. How much more could we have done if we understood apraxia and co-regulation and truly presumed competence from the start? If you're an educator working with students with autism, I can't stress this enough. Make it a priority to learn about apraxia and co-regulation. We need more balance in how we prepare and support our teachers. It's not just about behavior or compliance. It's about opening doors to communication and possibility. Share this episode with a colleague who's building inclusive schools. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And follow Think Inclusive wherever you get your podcasts. Shout out to the school teams at St. Michael's Elementary in Talbot County and Deal Island Elementary in Somerset County. Thank you so much for graciously letting me record interviews and observe some of the activities MCIE is doing to build a shared understanding of inclusive education. I wish I could spend more time with all of you. You are all asking and wrestling with the right questions. Keep going. Don't give up. This is the work. If you have something to share, you can always email me at tviegas@mcie.org. All right, time for the credits. Think Inclusive is brought to you by me, Tim Viegas. I write, edit, mix, master. I basically wear all the podcast hats and baseball caps. This show is a proud production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, scheduling and extra production help from Jill Wagoner. Our original music is by Miles Kredich with extra vibes from Melody. Big thanks to our sponsor, IXL. Visit IXL.com/inclusive. Fun fact, did you know that Testudo, the bronze terrapin statue at the University of Maryland, is famous for bringing good luck to anyone who rubs its nose? And When I was on campus interviewing students and peer mentors from the TERP Succeed program, a program for students with intellectual disabilities who go to college just like everyone else, I made sure to give Testudo's nose a good rub for luck. Here's hoping it brings a little extra good fortune to all of us. Do you have any special traditions for good luck? I'd love to know about it. Email me at tvegas@mcie.org. I read every single message. And if you've made it this far, you're officially part of the Think Inclusive Inclusion crew. Want to help us keep moving the needle for inclusion? Head to mcie.org and click donate. Give $5, $10, $20. It helps us keep partnering with schools and districts to move inclusive practices forward and support educators doing the work. Find us on the socials, almost everywhere at Think Inclusive. Thanks for hanging out. And remember, inclusion always works.
From MCIE.
Podcast roll. Welcome in.